This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, the constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. Last November, we definitely had an historic election, and one of the results that made history was that the majority in the Kentucky state legislature was Republican for the first time in nearly a century. And on Monday of last week, Kentucky State Senator Robert Stivers joined FRC President Tony Perkins to talk about the change in power that is going on there.
Senator, thank you for joining us here on Washington Watch.
Glad to do so, Tony.
Senator, let me ask you, how are Republicans, now that you have this new majority in Kentucky, how are you using it?
Well, the first week, which was unusual circumstance, in fact, I don't think we've ever done anything like this in my 20 years here, we moved to pass several bills we felt would be beneficial to encouraging businesses to locate here or expand, by passing what we call the right to work legislation, which would allow an individual to work at a place that would be defined as a shop, but not be a participant in negotiations or benefits. Also, what is called the basic wage. We did that, which artificially set labor pay rates on governmental projects to an artificially high number, which caused the taxpayer dollars to be less efficiently spent. These are two things the union wanted. We felt it was better for us to repeal those and go back to market-based performance, setting that, and having an open shop so people could work. It moved quickly. We did it the first week, which has been 10 days required by our Constitution. But that was what we felt was appropriate.
Now, Senator, you talk very matter-of-factly about that, that is a pretty significant move. In fact, only four states that have gained Republican majorities in November have moved in that direction, Iowa, Missouri, and Kentucky as well. This is pretty significant when you talk about right to work. I mean, I was in the Louisiana legislature a number of years ago when that was a big battle. Of course, it's been good for the economy of the state. So, I mean, it makes good economic sense. But politically, that's pretty difficult. How'd you get that done?
Well, it is difficult. And I think most people remember what happened in Wisconsin, may have been the most notable area or state. But soon after the election was over and we knew we had a significant majority in the House, the governor, myself, the new Speaker of the House, got together, actually the governor, I'd been talking about it for a couple of weeks. We strategized to make sure we had everything in place, had our scheduling sequence, and the natural tendency would be go after the newly elected House. We moved them out of the House as quickly as possible and got them to the Senate because we've been a supermajority for almost 6 or 7 years now.
Now, I forgot to mention New Hampshire was the other state that's moved on these business-related, economic-related, economic development-related, however you want to describe them. But just so our listeners understand, this has not been at the forefront of a lot of the political battles in recent years. It's been simmering at various state levels. But essentially what this does, it's much bigger because this is really dismantling the left's power base, because when you have these states where you have closed shop, where if you're going to get a job, you have to join a union, and your union dues then goes to support the candidates that most of these unions want to support, and that tends to be Democrats. So this has ripple effects across the political landscape, does it not?
It does, and it has huge impacts, but it is not something that we just did with those two bills. We also did what we called the paycheck protection, where you had to affirmatively opt out of the public unions, or you would be in the unions with dues being deducted, even though you may not know about it. that may have been as significant for leveling the playing field as anything on a political basis that we did during the first week. But truly, it is significant. It is significant from an economic standpoint because we believe we have a third more of the individuals who would be looking at the state. And a political standpoint, as I said earlier, it levels the playing field for many people who were involved in the electoral process.
Without question. There's nothing that is equitable on the right, if you will. I mean, there's no place where, you know, you have to, your money goes to support political candidates that the people you work for are supportive of. And this, you know, even corporate America with the profits that they use, although it's not directly taken from people's paychecks, it's taken from the profits of consumers, they tend to go to the left as well. So this is, you're absolutely right. This radically alters the playing field to make it level. But I think in the long run, as you pointed out, this is good for the state of Kentucky in this case, for economic development, as we've seen back in my home state of Louisiana as well. So, Senator Stivers, what else is on the chalkboard for the majority there in the Bluegrass State to do?
Well, we still want to do everything we can do to make this as business-friendly a state as possible. We also know that when we think about our philosophies, we have fiscal or business philosophies, but we're also about making some strong social statements because we are a socially conservative state. So we went ahead and also in the first week, bills that had been blocked by the Democrat-controlled House, two pro-life bills, we passed both of those in the first week, which the primary one was the ban of any abortion after 20 weeks. We know that with withstand judicial scrutiny. We took what we felt we could legally get by with in the federal court system. But then as we go into this next part of the session, because we have a three-week break, we continue to want to create hope, opportunity, change our school systems, better educate our students to where we will have a better workforce and, again, be more competitive to create jobs and opportunity. That's where we're moving.
So one final question for you, Senator Stivers. What would you say to the Republican majority in Washington? You know, they now are in control, much like the Republicans in Kentucky and nearly a quarter of the states, half the states, I should say, in the country. What would your recommendation be to them when it comes to their reform agenda?
Well, you know, the first thing I would respond to the legislative bodies in Washington is something that we have heard from both Senator McConnell, which is our United States senators, and others. Elections have consequences, and those consequences are the people who are in control are going to make the decisions and move that direction. And whether or not you agree with it, it's the reality. And instead of being just an obstructionist to be an obstructionist, be constructive. Try to work with the majority party, and quit basically trying to stop things just for political gains. Think about the long-term policy, because truly, I believe these are political in nature, but the most important thing is everything we've done here in Kentucky has good policy to
right.
it as well.
Now, have the Democrats then come along and worked with you on some of these reform policies now?
Well, let's On some, we did have a few Democrat votes along the line for some of the what we call the fiscal or business-oriented legislation. We had substantial numbers of Democrats. Almost half of all the Democrats voted for our social issues. So it was significant from that perspective that we had such bipartisan support for the social issues, and a limited number on the what I would call the fiscal or business
right.
issue.
Not surprised. Actually, my family's roots are from Kentucky. My mother born in Possum Trot, Kentucky. It is a conservative state.
Possum Trot, Kentucky.
Yes, Possum
Clay
Trot.
Clay County?
Yeah, not many people know where Possum Trot is.
Oh, so, I know right where it is. That's my district.
Well, you have some of my family probably still some of your constituents. Senator, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on a job well done.
Thank you.
You can find more on Senator Stivers when you visit TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at what sage conservatives are thinking.
Marriages everywhere are in crisis. The divorce rate is sky high. What can turn things around? The key lies in what God has bestowed on mankind, incarnational attachment. This in turn leads to the transforming power of being emotionally present in marriage. In a profound lecture by Dr. Jesse Gill, discover more about embracing God's design for attachment for marriage and our Christian faith in ways that bring transformation and growth. Visit frc.org/events to view this lecture and many more.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. On Wednesday's edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, Executive Director of the American Culture and Faith Institute and founder of the Barna Research Group, George Barna, joined Tony to discuss their latest poll on what they called sage conservatives, or spiritually active, governance engaged. Here's Tony Perkins.
George, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, Tony. Good to be with you.
All right. Some interesting information in your latest survey of sage cons. They, not surprised that they're upset with the culture. In fact, overwhelmingly, they don't think America is culturally in a good place. But the reaction to that might be a bit surprising. What do they want to do?
Well, in essence, this is a group of people who has been frustrated for a long time, and they're looking now at the fact that maybe there's a leader in the White House, at least, who's willing to take some tough stands and lead them forward. What we found, encouragingly, is that 2 out of 3 of them, literally 67%, said that they are either extremely or very interested in personally being involved in activities designed to produce positive cultural transformation in America in the near future. And so I think the challenge now is, all right, so what are the leaders of the Christian conservative community going to do?
Now, I don't know if your numbers show this, because I don't know how long that you've been looking at the sage cons, but I know just a couple of years ago, many of these that would fall into that same category as sage cons were beginning to question whether or not it was just time to turn away from cultural engagement and move on to something else. It appears to be that there is a renewed energy, a renewed vision for literally transforming the culture. And I guess for me, the good thing is it's not all looking to Washington, D.C. and somebody else to do it. They're ready to roll up their sleeves and do it themselves.
Absolutely. You know, you think back 4 or 5 years ago, and there was actually a big movement afoot of many Christian leaders saying, you know what, the culture wars are over. We've got to get away from that. We don't even want to use that language anymore. But the reality is that over the last few years, whether they wanted to believe it or not, that war heated up. And so part of what our survey did was look at the perspective that conservative Christians have about the culture. Overwhelmingly negative. They're very frustrated by it. And so now they do want to shift things to a whole different place.
Well, George Barna, let me ask you this. This renewed emphasis or this renewed desire to personally be a part of changing things. And I know that Donald Trump was not the candidate of preference for most of these sage cons, at least not in the primary. Now, I know they voted overwhelmingly for him in the general election, but going into the election cycle, he was not their candidate. But could it be that the victory that Donald Trump won against all odds, pushing back against the secular media and the elite, that that's given renewed hope to these sage cons that the culture actually can be transformed, not by Donald Trump, but the fact that somebody can make a difference?
Yeah, I think that's indisputably the case. What we know is that back in the early days of the primary, Mr. Trump was actually the fifth most popular choice among this group. Only about 10% said that they would support him. Obviously, the election unfolded, things changed. Now they're looking at him and they see that, okay, he's talking about religious freedom. He's talking about Israel. He's doing things related to abortion. You look at the people he's put in the cabinet. Many of them devoted Christians, people who hold similar values to evangelicals. They're saying, you know what, he's a little difficult to stomach sometimes, but it seems like he's moving in the direction that we want to move in. So, yeah, I mean, let's give him our support, but then let's also open up channels of activity in many other dimensions of our culture.
whether we're talking about families or the media or schools or wherever it may be that has influence on how we think and how we behave, now's the time for us to continue moving things forward while we have this window of opportunity.
George, let me ask you this question. You contend, and I'm quoting from your findings here, the danger is that many Christian leaders appear to be waiting for the Trump administration to work some magic to turn the culture around. There's a risk here that if people think that Donald Trump is the answer, they're going to miss the opportunity.
Absolutely, and that's why it's important that, yes, we support the president in the things that make sense, but we not assume that he and his administration and other political leaders are going to do everything that needs to be done to transform the culture in a positive way. We have probably never seen a political leader who's been able to do that. And I think as our culture becomes increasingly complex and difficult to manage and lead, we're never going to see one person or one entity that can do it all. So we're going to have to approach this from many different angles, using a variety of resources to alter the way that so many Americans are thinking. We can't wait for the great savior in the White House to do it. That's not where the action is going to come from.
Well, is there a sense that he gives kind of space because he's been pushing back against the cultural bullies? And so with him standing up, and while they may not agree on everything, they see him as at least providing them the right and the opportunity to stand up and speak into the culture without fear of, being silenced, bullied, or demonized.
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. You know, to use a football analogy, it's almost as if the president and his team are the front line, the front offensive line of the football team, and they're trying to push everybody back and make some room to gain some yardage,
right,
some cultural yardage in this case, so that we can actually move downfield and see America embrace values, or at least have an opportunity to consider values that are biblical in nature and would be in the ultimate best interest of the nation.
So, George, what's the role of the church now in this process? What do these SageCons see the church in its role?
As they look at what's going on, they were, based on our research throughout the election season, most SageCons were very disappointed that their church did not play much of a role. Obviously, some churches did, but most conservative, evangelically oriented churches in America did not really engage during the election. And so they're hoping that now maybe the leaders of their church will say, all right, well, we're not about an election now, but we want to keep our people informed. We want to help them understand what the issues mean. We want to help them understand what it means to be a witness or a role model in a culture that clearly is searching for solid footing. And so they're looking to their churches to network them together, to build a larger community, even beyond the walls of their own church, to the larger Christian community, so that we can have a greater presence in the marketplace, in the greater public atmosphere, and have the opportunity to tell our side of the story, to reveal the narrative as we see it, so that at least there is something for people to be thinking about.
So George, let me follow up with that. Is there a risk then for churches if they fail to respond to this need, as the SageCons see it, that the SageCons then may just move on to another vehicle to be this cultural change agent that they're looking for?
Yes, I think one of the things that we noticed in the election season was that a lot of people recognized that parachurch ministries and other organizations were the ones who were really fighting the fight at a grassroots level. And so a lot of Christians around the country now are watching very carefully. It's not that they're at all against the local church, but there are certain realities that they need their church to pay attention to and to provide support with, so that they themselves can be the most effective Christian individuals they can possibly be in representing Christ in the culture.
Fascinating stuff, George. As always, great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
Thank you, sir.
You can find out more about George Barna as well as the American Culture and Faith Institute when you visit tonyperkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
What will Donald do during his first 100 days in office? Family Research Council has laid out a conservative playbook for the president-elect to follow in order to repair some of the damage done by the Obama administration's liberal elite special interests. In a timely panel discussion, policy experts lay out a game plan of actions that the Trump administration can take in its first 100 days. Visit frc.org/first100 to view this policy discussion.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Earlier this week, Family Research Council hosted a live webcast that we called Privacy and Freedom, Good for Business. During that discussion, we talked about what some states are doing to protect the safety and privacy of women and children in restrooms and locker rooms, and how to defend the freedom to believe, especially against the push by LGBT activists for transgender bathrooms. FRC President Tony Perkins had a chance to talk with one of our speakers, Kaylee Triller Haver, who was fired from her job at the YMCA for not going along with their bathroom policy. Here now is Tony Perkins.
Kaylee, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, you had problems with the policy, and you didn't want to go along with it. And tell us what happened and why.
Sure. There were multiple issues that I had with the policy. So when this was all happening, it was about 2 years ago, and this had not broken out in the national scene at all. In fact, I had not heard of transgender bathroom issues in any capacity. And so I thought it was just contained to this little YMCA organization that I was working for.
And this was in Washington State?
In Washington State. Mm-hmm. And so when my boss came to me and asked me to draft the talking points for it, I was just bewildered on a couple different levels.
Yeah, I forgot to mention, you were the communications director for YMCA.
That's right. And I'd worked at the Y in some capacity for 17 years. It was home. My first job there was locker room monitor, which I still find ironic. But they wanted me to sell this new policy, and I had a couple of problems with it, primarily, first of all, because I'm a Christian, and I worked for a Christian organization that, in my opinion, existed to advance the gospel of Jesus Christ, and I thought that this was really offensive to compromise truth this way as a Christian organization. But when we got a little bit more into it, I realized that one of my primary issues with this was that as a survivor of sexual trauma, I knew how incredibly difficult it was for a lot of women like me to use a locker room at all. Mm-hmm. And I was hypervigilant at the Y. I would regularly conduct my own screenings to make sure sex offenders weren't getting in. We had thousands of little kids going to shower every day before swimming lessons. And every time I would run a screening, I would find at least one predator who had somehow found a way to get in. And I've sat with the victims. I have reviewed surveillance footage after they've been harmed already. And what people need to understand is that these policies that are emerging do not exist to protect transgender people. They are all written around a subjective term called gender identity, which is the same thing as anything goes.
Right.
And so any man could be walking in to our locker rooms and declare his right to shower next to my little girl. And that was just not something that I could do.
So what happened then, Kaylee, when you raised these concerns with the management?
They ultimately, after kind of hashing some of this out, I remember telling my boss why. This is the first time in my adult life I had ever mentioned my own history of sexual trauma. And she looked at me and she said, you know, Kaylee, anytime I'm feeling the way that you're feeling right now, I just convince myself I'm being closed-minded. And they ultimately decided to impose these locker room policies without telling our members. And so I knew that every day there are people going in and out of these locker rooms and that women like me could somehow turn around and be confronted by the sight of a naked male, and they wouldn't have had time to prepare for that. So I ended up deciding to tell people about it because I felt like that was completely wrong.
Now, Kayla, let me make sure I'm clear on this.
Yeah.
They instituted this policy without telling the membership of the Y?
That's right. 120,000 members.
And this includes parents who are sending their children.
That's right. And trusting the Y to, I mean, one of the core values of the YMCA is honesty. And so I had signed this contract that said I would keep confidential information confidential. But that same contract had also said that I would act in the best interest of the members. And I was finding that I couldn't do both. And so they fired me. And they said that they would let me resign with severance as long as I didn't tell anybody about what was going on, or I could just be fired on the spot. And somebody who'd been silenced enough, I was going to talk.
Amazing that they're trying to cover up the tracks on this. Now, Kaylee, we're almost out of time, but you've been leading an effort in Washington State to overturn the bathroom policies there, getting the citizens involved. Who's been your strongest allies in this?
We've had allies from the most unlikely places. You know, a couple core people in my hometown of Tacoma who were Y members have really shouldered a lot of the burden. Alliance Defending Freedom has been helpful, obviously the Family Research Council, and then quite a large group of radical feminists and lesbians who have been fighting for women's rights and see this as a women's rights issue have also come alongside.
What about the church? Where's the church been?
Honestly, largely absent, and it's been very, very sad. We need more. We've got some vocal, strong, bold churches. But out of 150 churches that one volunteer asked to help, seven said yes because they don't do politics or they don't want to be unloving to the transgender population. So they don't actually see, I think, down the pike and what this actually means.
But I don't think they see the victims of the sexual trauma that are out there that are now faced with really an untenable situation.
They don't. You know, and that's the thing. I have yet to see a single news report of a trans woman being harmed as a result of being forced into the wrong locker room.
Wow.
I have daily reports of women being harmed.
If you missed any of today's program, you can find a link to it by heading over to tonyperkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.